The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Jen Rogers from the North Carolina Reading Service, previously known as the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from Smithsonian Magazine. Today's programming is underwritten with the generous support of Carl and Kat Keppen. We wish to thank them for their support. On today's program, we'll be reading from the January and February 2020 issue of Smithsonian Magazine, and we'll start with an article titled, "The Charlatan Will See You Now," by Jeff McGregor. A notorious quack peddled cures at an Arkansas hotel in the 1930s. Nowadays, the con game is all for show. They found the bottles buried on the edge of the woods behind the hotel last spring. Specimen bottles, mostly, each about the size of a jam jar, give or take. Many intact, some still filled with clear liquid yellowing to brown, then molasses black. The wax and rubber seals of the glass stoppers cracked, but somehow holding after 80 years in the ground. Others pristine, as if they'd been just shipped from the lab. In the first hour or so, the groundskeeper unearthed scores of them. But even in the bright light of morning, it was impossible to judge which body parts they held. By the end of the day, the staff had pulled hundreds from the tree line down the hill, and everyone in Eureka Springs knew what they'd found. The next day, everyone in Arkansas knew, and by the end of the week, everyone in America knew they'd found bottles and jars and body parts behind the Crescent Hotel, and that the sheriff and the coroner had come and gone, and the archaeology team from the university in Fayetteville was on its way. Built in 1886, the Crescent Hotel in Eureka Springs, Arkansas, is the grandest resort in the Ozarks. By the time of the Depression, it sits empty. In 1937, it becomes the Baker Hospital. Norman Baker claims to have a cure for cancer. The colorful mailers and brochures he sends out refers to the area as the Switzerland of America, under the cheery banner, where sick folks get well, and promise that cancer is curable without the knife or radium or X-ray. But Norman Baker is a quack. That's why the medical board ran him out of Iowa, then chased him down to Mexico. Norman Baker is not a doctor. Norman Baker is a charlatan. He is conventionally handsome, sharp-featured, and clear-eyed, confidence-inspiring, straight out of a B-movie casting call. He has a well-cut head of distinguished gray hair and a strong jaw balanced on a celluloid shirt collar. Is the gaze level? The handshake firm? Are the palms cool and dry? You bet. His patients, the suckers and the gulls and the true believers, are weak with sickness, desperate, pale. They come from everywhere and pay cash for their treatments. They pay and pay. Baker promises life. He promises vigor. No surgery, no radiation, just Formula 5 and the power of positive thinking. Baker drives a hand-hammered, coach-built Cord automobile, custom-painted in electric lavender. He wears dark, chalk-stripe three-piece suits in winter, white suits and matching shoes in summer, lilac shirts year-round. He sports a diamond horseshoe stick pin and a watch fob heavy as an anchor chain. In the leanest years of our history, he doesn't hide the money he grifts from the sick and the hopeless. He broadcasts it. He brags it. He is loud with it. He's the picture of vulgar American excess. Formula 5 is alcohol, glycerol, carbolic acid, groundwater melon seed, corn silk, and clover leaves. It is administered by injection at the site of the cancer up to 7 times a day. Baker stole the recipe from another con man. It does nothing. Illness is an island. There is no loneliness like sickness. You feel it in these rooms, not isolation, but desolation. The Crescent, restored, is still open and more popular than ever, in part because it bills itself as America's most haunted hotel. On the ghost tour, they tell you these stories. Michael, the stonemason flirt from Ireland, falling to his death during the hotel's construction, now and forever romancing guests in room 218. Brecky, the 4-year-old boy, taken up by illness 100 years ago, lately playing in the hall and photobombing tourist selfies and snapshots. Theodora, 80 years dead and still trying to find her key in front of room 419. An obsessive-compulsive packer of guest suitcases when angry. The nurse, pushing a gurney through eternity on the third floor, and perhaps most famously, the girl in the mist, who from time to time to time, always around 10:30 in the moonlight, will fall or fling herself from one of the east side balconies into the garden below. She is shrouded in mist as she falls, as is her story. There's no record of an event like this at the hotel, but folks claim to have seen the ghost, a white radiance plummeting from darkness to darkness, and they wonder, was she pushed? Did she jump? Was she, is she, a character straight out of Dreiser, pregnant and unwed and ruined, killed by despair and Victorian convention? Here the implausible yields to history, as the hotel was, for a few years anyhow, a distinguished college and conservatory for young women. From 1908 until 1924, the hotel bolstered its summer tourist revenue by becoming a destination boarding school for the edification of American womanhood. According to the Encyclopedia of Arkansas, an early advertisement in Cosmopolitan magazine read as follows: Crescent College and Conservatory for Women, on top of the Ozarks, famous for healthfulness and beauty of location. $300,000 fireproof building, rooms with private bath, elevator, accredited junior college, general courses, art, music, expression, domestic science. But there's no evidence that any fallen or falling woman was a student. On the fourth floor, in what used to be the faculty lounge, is now a small museum and library where the history of this place is made vivid. Historian and artist and storyteller Rebecca Becker keeps the memory of the conservatory days alive. There are exhibits and display cases and even a small stage. And Keith Scales is in charge of the ghost tours that begin here, and the ghost stories, and they work together to make the hotel the lively old dame she is. The Ozarks are a crossroads, and over the last 10,000 years or so, Eureka Springs has attracted pilgrims and seekers of every kind. It was said that waters healed the sick and made you whole again, so the Osage chief who carved out the Holy Basin next to the spot where the Basin Park Hotel now stands on Spring Street would recognize the impulse, if not the architecture. This has always been a boom and bust town and a hideout and a rest cure, a place to lay low or live high. Bank robbers, bootleggers, railroad magnates, and cat house madams all made their fortunes here. Gangsters from Chicago kept the hotels and roadhouses and nightclubs busy after World War II. And when the local economy swooned in the 1970s, hippies saved the place and its storied gingerbread homes so that it became an arts oasis. It remained so. Over the years, Scales has performed a one-man Norman Baker show many times on that small upstairs stage. He and Becker do their best to make the Crescent a history project rather than merely a haunted house. In addition to the ghost tours and the haunted hotels and the springs and the baths, Eureka Springs has galleries and restaurants and bars and a beautiful old Carnegie Library. There is a passion play here as well, and an opera company, and the Christ of the Ozark statue 7 stories high. The eroded Ozarks plateau, upon which all of this rests, is hundreds of millions of years old. Walk 10 feet into the trees and you're part of prehistory. The woods resonate with the ancient animism. The forest hums with it. You can hear them breathe. There's something heavy in the quiet here, though, some weight to the air, especially at sundown or right before dawn when the mist hangs in the cuts and hollows. There's something eerie in it, dreamlike, something deep and uneasy. In the hotel, it's the same. Every stairwell and landing is fraught. Every empty hallway feels crowded. Every room you enter feels as if someone just left. You are alone, but never alone here. And to the suggestible, to the willing, that's the point of the place. To be a little frightened by the supernatural. To feel alive in the company of the dead. In the dark, everything is a ghost story. But even the skeptical are moved here. if not to fear, then to sadness. The sharp historical sense of dread and of pain and loss can be overwhelming if you open yourself to it. Because worse than any monster is a man like you or me. Weak, greedy, unaccountable. Selling hope to the hopeless. If you checked into the Baker Hospital, your room holds everything you ever lost. The morgue smells of dust. It smells of dampness and dust and stone. It holds the heat of the day in the front room, but the farther in you walk, the cooler it gets. The morgue is not in the basement, but it is dark and low-ceilinged, and you may imagine the weight of the hotel on top of you. The refrigerator where they kept the bodies is the last stop on the ghost tour. And in an alcove are shelves with more of the specimen and sample jars of the kind that were found down the hill. Many of these hold indeterminate bits of flesh and were displayed in the lobby of the hotel when it was the cancer hospital. There was a ghost sighting in this room, right where you're standing, on a recent Ghost Hunters TV show. It plays on loop behind you. There's a commercial kitchen utility counter and a sink against one wall, which some people mistake for an autopsy table. The morgue was probably a pantry, but for the few years of Norman Baker's Cancer is Curable Hospital, the dead were brought down here to wait for the hearse from the local funeral home. On the day Germany invaded Poland, September 1st, 1939, Norman Baker was arrested for mail fraud. That's how they got him, the brochures. He was tried and convicted and sent to Leavenworth. Norman Baker was a charlatan in the long, terrible tradition of American charlatans. A liar and a thief who stole broken promises. Norman died a Florida retiree in 1958. He had cirrhosis and cancer. I think they're pig parts, Scale says of the contents of the specimen jars. Not surgical excisions. Not even human bits cribbed from the local mortician. Pickled trims and ends bought from the local butcher, maybe. Or specimens ordered from a medical school supply house. We'll get the results once the university tests them. But the jars will make no sense even then, even as an advertising device. Baker claimed to cure cancer without surgery. Why bother displaying fake tumors? Because people desperate to be persuaded don't think. They want to be convinced. They want to be sold. They want to believe, because they ache to live. And maybe that's what you get from coming here, from every one of these ghost stories. A lesson in longing. Life persists. Life insists on life. So maybe in the middle of that first long night you wake. You fumble for the light and walk to the window. Behind you, the old hotel creaks and groans. Outside, the invisible valley is all silence and darkness. What you see on the glass is your own reflection. The only ghost in this room is you. Next, we'll move on to an article in the prologue section of Smithsonian Magazine titled Tracing the Enslaved by Amy Crawford. A massive new online database connecting billions of records offers vital details about slavery's toll. In 1834, a 22-year-old Yoruba man who had come to be known as Manuel Vidal was captured as a prisoner of war and sold to slave traders in Lagos, today the largest city in Nigeria. A Spanish ship transported him to Cuba, where he was sold to a white man who forced him to roll 400 cigars a day. If his pace slowed, he recalled, he would be stripped, tied down, and flogged with the cowhide. A decade later, however, Vidal secured permission from a new owner to hire himself out, and with his earnings, he bought a share in the lottery ticket, and won. That allowed him to buy his freedom. He married a fellow former slave, Maria Picard, and they adopted a young relative whose parents had died of cholera. Vidal supported his wife and son by continuing to roll cigars, eventually making enough money to cover their passage to England. Vidal's stroke of fortune is known today only because he had a chance encounter with a representative of the British and Foreign Anti-Slavery Society. The organization recorded his story in its journal, which was later shelved in a university library, digitized, and eventually collected in an online database called Freedom Narratives. Enslaved people like Vidal, torn away from their communities of origin, deprived of the ability to write about themselves and treated as cargo or property in official documents, often left little of themselves to the historic record. Still, even a few facts can shape the outline of a life of sorrow, adversity, perseverance, and triumph. One of the biggest challenges in slave studies is the idea that people were unknowable, that the slave trade destroyed individuality, says Darrell Williams, a historian at the University of Maryland. But the slave trade didn't erase people. We have all kinds of information that's knowable. Property records, records related to births, deaths, and marriages. There are billions of records. It just takes a lot of time to go look at them and to trace the arc of an individual life. Williams, a specialist in the African diaspora of Brazil, is one of the principal investigators of a massive new online database called Enslaved, Peoples of the Historic Slave Trade, which will launch later this year. It aims to serve as a clearinghouse for information about enslaved people and their captors. Headquartered at Matrix, the Center for Digital Humanities and Social Sciences at Michigan State University, and funded by a founding $1.5 million grant from the Mellon Foundation, Enslaved will serve as a hub for many smaller digitization projects, freedom narratives among them. For the first time, says Williams, anyone from academic historians to amateur genealogists will be able to trace individuals, families, ethnic groups, and populations through dozens, hundreds, or even thousands of archives, making connections that will enrich our understanding of slavery. This tool, Williams says, will have the potential to show that even in the context of this horrible crime, there are still threads that hold people's lives together. The study of the historic slave trade depends on numbers. The 12.5 million people kidnapped from Africa and shipped to the New World between 1525 and 1866, the 10.7 million who survived the two-month voyage, the 3.9 million enslaved in the United States just before the Civil War. These figures are horrifying, but at the same time, their very enormousness can have a numbing effect, which is why contemporary historians are increasingly turning to biography. Individual stories make a difference, says Leslie Harris, a historian at Northwestern University who writes about and teaches the history of slavery. We do need to know the vast numbers that we're talking about, that this was the largest forced migration in history. But when you begin to talk about these big concepts in terms of individual lives, you can better understand what these things mean. The challenge, says Harris, who is not affiliated with the Enslaved Project, has been to move beyond the well-told stories of once enslaved activists like Harriet Tubman and Frederick Douglass. The linked open data at the core of the Enslaved Archive offers broader possibilities. This project is so important, Harris says. It could help us gain a greater understanding of how people weren't just swept up in history, but how they spoke back to power, how they fought for their families. It's always been easiest to assemble a vivid picture about people whose lives are well documented, whether in letters, newspapers, or official records held in libraries and archives. For that reason, the doings of white people from the upper classes have long made up the core of what Americans and Europeans tend to think of as history. For too long, it has been difficult, painstaking, and often impossible to write histories of all but a relatively few Americans of African descent, because documents have not been organized in a way that allows that, explains Walter Hawthorne, a historian at Michigan State and one of the Enslaved Project's principal investigators. Documentation often exists, but has not been well preserved, well cataloged, and made searchable. Historians, of course, have long made good use of various records, from plantation inventories and escaped slave advertisements to personal narratives collected by obscure abolition societies. But those details are housed at far-flung institutions and not consistently organized. Jane Landers, a historian at Vanderbilt University, set out in 2003 to change that. Since that time, the project called the Slave Society's Digital Archive has digitized some 700,000 pages of religious and other documents from colonial Brazil, Colombia, Cuba, Florida, and Angola. Unlike in the English colonies, where enslaved people were treated almost exclusively as property, In Spanish and Portuguese America, they were considered fully human with souls to be saved, Landers says. Their life events were faithfully recorded, often by the Catholic Church. The earliest of these archives date to the 16th century. We keep finding surprises, Landers says. We have found records from long-abandoned Franciscan missions in the middle of nowhere in Brazil, for cities that no longer exist in Cuba or in Haiti. Wonderful scholars before me have used some of these ecclesiastics' records and incorporated them into studies, but nobody had really studied them at length or made a point of collecting them. By partnering with Enslaved, the Slave Society's digital archive can link their work with other collections. Emory University, for example, has digitized records of nearly 36,000 historic slaving voyages and details of 91,491 Africans liberated by naval courts, which will also be included in Enslaved. The Matrix team at Michigan State hosts an open-access archive about enslaved people in Louisiana, which includes names, ethnicities, and occupations of individuals listed in government records. And Harvard's Hutchins Center for African and African American Research, led by Henry Louis Gates Jr., is contributing a selection of its collected biographies of people of African descent. What we want to do is to take a portion of everyone's data and put it in one big pot, says Dean Rehberger, the director of Matrix and another of Enslaved's principal investigators. Then we can see if the same person appears in more than one, and we can build up these fragments and put them together. It turns out there's a surprisingly simple way to turn life histories, ship manifests, census records, and other information into machine-readable data. The semantic triple, which involves entering information in three-part sentences, each with a subject, a predicate, and an object. It's something like, Maria Picard was born in 1822. Or, Maria Picard married Manuel Vidal, explains Rehberger. Since three-part units of information can be mined from any biography, list, article, or directory, and then linked to other information units in a vast network. Thanks to modern computing power, so-called triple stores now exist with hundreds of billions of entries on every topic imaginable. The Michigan State team has spent 2 years building their own vast network of triples. But the project, they realize, may never be complete. The historic slave trade lasted nearly 350 years and touched millions of lives, and there remain undiscovered or little-known troves of information around the world. Even a family Bible could hold a valuable data point. So in addition to acting as a database for existing slavery information, Enslaved will also offer a publishing platform for data with a peer review process modeled after scholarly journals. Historians tend to just go out and collect what they want, whatever they need for their particular thing, Rehberger says. But what if you actually went to a physical archive thinking in larger terms, that this is something that could be of value to others? We want people to see that publishing data is an important part of humanities research, just like it is in the sciences. And isn't it interesting to think that digital humanities is going to be led, transformed even, by slave studies? After Manuel Vidal and his wife Maria Picard set sail for England, they hope to return to Lagos and reunite with family they had seen decades before. It isn't known if they ever made it home, but perhaps in some ship's manifest or census record waiting to be digitized and connected, there lies a clue to the fate of this ordinary man who made a life for himself against all odds. Next, we'll move on to the Ask Smithsonian portion of the magazine. First, we start with a question from Matthew Chase of Washington, D.C. I've read that ostriches lay the biggest eggs, but what land bird lays the biggest egg for its body size? That would be the North Island brown kiwi, says Kathy Brader, senior bird keeper at the National Zoo, which in 1975 bred the first kiwi outside of its native New Zealand. A female kiwi lays an egg that is 15 to 22% of her weight. A male then incubates the eggs for 68 to 91 days. When the chick hatches, it is soon self-sufficient and won't imprint on its parents. Unlike most birds, female brown kiwis have two functioning ovaries, and unlike other kiwi species, they lay multiple eggs per season. A question from Anonymous from Boston is, where does the phrase lame duck come from? A British economics term from the 18th century It referred to someone going bankrupt. The term was first applied to the presidency in the winter of 1928-9 as Calvin Coolidge waited out the end of his term. In 1933, the states ratified the 20th Amendment, or the lame duck amendment, to shorten the time between the election and the inauguration. Claire Jerry, curator of political history at the National Museum of American History, suggests that the long wait time didn't suit an uneasy electorate in the midst of the Depression and underscored the delay, originally put in place to account for the difficulty of traveling to the Capitol, had become outdated. President Franklin D. Roosevelt's first inauguration was the last to be held in March. His other three were in January. Anna Andrews from Walnut Creek, California asks, how many astronauts work for NASA and what do they do when they're not in space? The number fluctuates, but there are currently 38 active astronauts. They spend their days training for future missions and developing hardware for new missions. Those heading to the International Space Station learn to use its equipment and learn Russian. They have to be fluent at a training center outside Moscow. Some of the other astronauts are assigned to the two commercial crew vehicles being developed by Boeing and SpaceX for flight in 2020, says Mike Neufeld, senior curator at the National Air and Space Museum's Space History Department. And some are specializing in the Orion spacecraft and the hardware for the Artemis program to go back to the moon. There are 16 astronauts no longer on flight status who hold administrative jobs at NASA around the United States. And finally, Bill Wackenzie from San Diego, California asks, why are there so many honeybees hanging around my swimming pool? They might be trying to cool off. When it's hot out, honeybees go searching for water. If they find it, they return to the hive and perform their waggle dance to communicate the water's location, says David Rubeck, a research entomologist at the Smithsonian Tropical Research Institute. A group of 15 or so bees will fly there and lap up the water. Back in the hive again, they'll pass droplets to receiver bees, who deposit the water along the edge of the wax comb. Bees inside the hive will fan their wings and circulate the water-cooled air. This DIY air conditioning helps maintain the hive at what scientists say is the temperature honeybees prefer, around 95 degrees Fahrenheit. We've run out of time for today's episode of Smithsonian Magazine. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Jen Rogers, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's programming is underwritten with the generous support of Carl and Pat Keppen. We wish to thank them for their support. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after this broadcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. So long until next time, if you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138.